And coming back there, dear listeners, and obviously, you know, just citing the particular lovely tunes that you've heard since the top of the hour, since 5 a.m. And ultimately that you're starting off your Sunday morning, as always, here in my company, and that of Eagle FM's company, as we always introduce your Sunday programming from this particular early period onwards. Obviously, you'll be in my company from 5 a.m. up until 7 a.m., and thus welcoming you to your Sunday morning session, my Sunday morning take here on what is the last Sunday of July. Yes, the past 2 days have been peculiar. I know, guys. For those of you, obviously, that I've seen in the central parts of the country, or that live in the central parts of the country, this peculiar weather that we've been experiencing, specifically with rainfall at nighttime. I mean, during the course of the day, you can see that the sunlight, or the strength of the sunlight, is pretty faint. You know, the sun is really competing against something there that is sort of like diluting its impact. Thus, it does not make sense to be out in the sun. If you were thinking about, you know, sort of like strengthening yourself through vitamin D supplementation. However, the peculiar scenario was that it was also not that cold, but it does make it a little bit, it does add a, you know, a little bit of a weird aspect to this particular past 2 days. I don't know where you find yourself, but hopefully that you are, you know, snuggled up, listening obviously to Eagle FM, and thus having a coffee in your hand. I do hope that you've got a coffee in your hand. I hope I had one right now, but nonetheless, as long as it's not as cold as what the other particular periods of this winter season was. Now, starting off with our program in earnest for this morning, welcoming you once again to my Sunday morning take, where we look at everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and a little bit of everything else in between, in order to help shape and understand what is actually happening in the world around us. Well, one of these particular developments that happened in the world around us actually caught my eye in this past week. Now, let me set the scene for you once again, and obviously get you into the particular aspect of our case study for this morning's session of my Sunday morning take. So, Ursula von der Leyen, the EU Commission president, and the EU Council chair, that is, I think it's the president or the prime minister of Portugal, they were in Beijing this past week. Now, this is as the EU and China were there to sort of like, you know, have once again some high-level talks regarding trade, regarding developments, regarding, you know, finding common grounds for, well, what can be considered two of the largest economic blocks in the world. Now, China obviously is not a bloc. China is a country. The EU is a bloc because it consists out of multiple countries. However, they do, the two of them together, have considerable clout together when obviously coming together, the top leaders, to iron out things. Now, remember, at the heart of the EU's particular economy are the German and the French economies, which act as sort of like the foundations for the EU economy. Then you add in the Italians, then you add in the Spanish, and so you can go on in terms of adding in all the other particular countries in terms of their positions in the G7 and G20 economies of the world. Yeah, if you guys did not know what the G7 and the G20 was all about, it's the size of your economy. So the size of your economy places your country in those two particular top-tier clusters of the nations of the world who have the world's largest economies. In the press conference of von der Leyen after she had one of her engagements with the Chinese president Xi Jinping, she used a particular term in her discussion. Now, she outlined obviously to the press that this is about finding common ground and ultimately trying to grow closer or develop closer to the Chinese market, and that both particular economies find positives out of the engagements that they're there to conduct. So now, I'm not going to go into the particular details of the positives or what each side was seeking, because that technically would convert our discussion into a purely trade talk. No. Our discussion is based upon a single term that von der Leyen used in that press conference. And that particular term is the basis for our analysis for this morning. You guys might have also heard it before, looking at international and Western particular media reports, and specifically where it came to a scenario of international relations, or they were talking about foreign relations, or international or foreign affairs in that specific report. The crux of the matter for our discussion is based upon this particular term. What is this term, you might ask? It's known, and it calls itself, and it is identified by its particular basic name as the rules-based order. Now, you guys would have heard of this term before. And it's not that there's much fanfare about the term, but I have heard so much about this term from Joe Biden's particular period as President of the United States. And then the term just keeps popping up ever since the particular Gaza conflict kicked off and the Ukraine conflict kicked off. This rules-based order. Now, what is this rules-based order? So, I thought it would probably have been about like a piece of legislation. Not really. Does it include pieces of legislation? Most probably. What does it actually consist of? It's actually in terms of the overall manner in which countries are currently dealing with each other and interacting with each other. And not just with each other, but also with multilateral organizations. Multilateral organizations obviously means the IMF, the World Bank, the World Health Organization, the UN itself, the AU, the EU, ASEAN, Mercosur from South America, and so on and so forth. Now, all these particular representations that I just indicated to you, dear listeners, is based upon the so-called rules-based order. Then you've got other initiatives which also speaks towards a rules-based order, but not the same rules-based order. You get the Commonwealth of Nations, which Namibia is part of, the one technically where I sometimes jokingly indicate to you, but this is a collection of former colonies with the former colonizer being in charge of this particular bracket. That's now obviously the United Kingdom. That in itself is a multilateral organization. You get to SADC. That is a multilateral organization. You get to, there's someone else, even SACU, which is a customs union. That is a multilateral organization. You get to, there's someone else I'm forgetting. There's another organization I'm forgetting. But all in all, dear listeners, all these particular aspects and indications, they firstly thrive in these examples that I just shared with you now. And why do they thrive? Well, specifically because since 1945, much of the political leadership since then have indicated they don't want to fight anymore, and they don't want to have, every country who does not like its neighbor or another country to just quickly rush to armaments and thus are quick to fight with each other. I mean, that's the whole basis of this particular, the existence of this particular term, but from the term it comes through from the basis of actions or the base of actions that have taken place since 1945. Now, when von der Leyen used that particular term, I found it peculiar. Rules-based order. What is rules-based order? Now, remember, I told you It was politicians who indicated since 1945 they don't want to settle disputes or issues between nations on the battlefield. They don't want to do that. But when you get into the rules-based order discussion, you still have to ask yourself, whose rules, whose order exists? So at the heart of our particular discussion, dear listeners, I factored in a couple of multilateral organizations for us to remember. We know most of them, but we've got to remember them all. Now, a particular academic from an American college, McAllister College. It's an American college, but it's one of those particular smaller colleges that no one has heard of. He outlines, because he's American, he outlines, and his particular field of study is obviously from political science in the US. He outlines what this particular phrase speaks to. Now, he encapsulates it in international rules-based order. My other resource, which comes literally through from the, I think this is from the British Parliament itself. Yeah, from the British Parliament, the library itself. And then the other two, the one is from a policy initiative think tank, which is also from the US. And the third is obviously sort of like a more neutral, resource that helps to sort of like factor in all particular sides. You know, if I saw that one of my other pieces of literature sort of like veered off into a pro bias, scenario. However, when you hear international rules-based order or that particular term, it only comes out of one side in the global environment, in the world environment. It only comes out of one side. Not even Namibian presidents have used that term much. Not even SADC leadership, meaning the chairpersons, the representatives, meaning each of the presidents in Southern Africa, have used that word. Not much. You won't find it easy in their speeches. And you won't hear them say it easy on a specific national broadcast. Because what we indicate specifically, if what you find in terms of African examples of a rules-based adherence, is we literally mention the institution's name. We say, in terms of UN Charter, we speak towards the organization that our country's aligned to. Or we say the Constitution of Namibia. Or we say in terms of so-and-so-and-so. We reference a particular document or a particular institution or a particular item. I mean, our president has been, she's cited and she's recorded this at every instance, she and her ministers, obviously, at every instant, the manifesto, specifically the ruling party's manifesto from the start, which helps you as a listener, you as the average person, you as the everyday person to go like, okay, so what is this document? Should I go and read it up? Then you go read it up and you could look into it and you go see, okay, what's going on in this document? Okay, so this part of this document is supposed to align with what the president recently spoke about. Let's say it was at a green hydrogen event. And how does this resonate with this document? If you see any correlation, yes, it's there. Boom, there you go. Because then at least you can see, okay, this is what it's based upon. The policy idea, the policy guidance stems from this particular document. This document ultimately was the basis for said particular presidential election win. And it sets the particular scene in terms of the next 5 years, which feeds into Namibia's NDP-6 that was recently launched back on Monday, last Monday, because we're starting off with a new Monday tomorrow. But you don't hear this from the Western leadership, from the Western politicians. Western, and I'm talking about predominantly EU, predominantly NATO. It narrows it pretty quickly down so that you know who I'm talking about. You will never hear about a singular document, a singular institution, a singular entity that everyone has signed up to. Because if you ask them, okay, so what are you basing this particular aspect of a rules-based order on? Whose rules are we playing by? Whose rules are we participating by? Who's the referee even? What is in it for me to adhere to these rules? Why must I participate in these rules? These are important questions, right? These are very, very, very pertinent and important questions to ask. However, on that particular sort of like thread, we'll keep it having there, dear listeners, and we'll be back right after the short musical break.
Digital Man. wish that I could change the weather. Enjoy the sound of silence in my car. There's things I just can't hate forever. I found a crowded place to fall apart. You can pay me on any IP.
Coming back there from the sounds of the Empire of the Sun. That's the group's name that just sang that particular song. And before that, it was Jamiroquai with Automaton. And ultimately bringing us up to what would be about 15 minutes out from the top of the hour for 6 a.m. And if you've just woken up, good morning, good morning, good morning. And this is my Sunday morning take. I weigh in my company from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. Leaving the music behind and obviously getting into the particular talking point or the sort of like bookmark in our discussion where we left off, I was going to cite to you the particular understanding in terms of whose rules-based order discussion. Now, this is where things get interesting because in some scenarios it is indicated as a challenge, supposedly. I say challenge. Well, here's one of the particular things. And I'm just, firstly, let's start from the first particular quote that I've got here prepared. The phrase international rules-based order has long been a fixture in global politics. Western leaders often use it to describe a framework of rules, norms, and institutions designed to guide state behavior. Advocates argue that this framework has provided the foundation for decades of stability and prosperity, while critics question its fairness and relevance in today's multipolar world. But you've got to ask yourself the particular question, where does it come from? So, the basis, the start, and everything obviously means that the rules-based international order, initially known as the Liberal International Order. Fixate on that part. Liberal international order emerged from the devastation of the Second World War. Now, the vision was ambitious and universal, to create a global system based on liberal democratic values, market capitalism, and multilateral cooperation. I will put the peg in terms of the bookmark right there for our particular analysis, because it obviously means the last two elements, besides the liberal international order, are key things to look at. Now, here is a scenario, dear listeners, and I'll start from the Afghan invasion, specifically in terms of the war against terrorism. If you're going to think that I am someone that's not against the war against terror, actually, I am very thankful, specifically, that the NATO nations or the NATO cluster of countries actually started this particular initiative, because there literally was a very strong presence of countries that were financing and that were supporting terror. Some of them obviously are within that NATO cluster of things, because if anybody remembers back to the discussions, obviously, of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, it was the Americans that supported the local Afghan rebels, and it was the Americans whose money flushed into that particular engagement, and it was the Americans that supplied hardware to, literally, American-made hardware to combat the Soviet, you know, the Soviet forces and the Soviet armies in the 80s. But we obviously find ourselves in the 2020s, because, I mean, we're midway we're through the middle of this decade, this 10-year period. We're battling on our way towards Vision 2030 in Namibia, Vision 2030 overall for the world, because that's what the SDGs wish to achieve by 2030. And, you know, there's a template. And in that template of both these particular visions, because Namibia has an overall umbrella vision, Vision 2030, it doesn't speak to any international rules-based discussions, but Namibia's particular alignment is fixated on or fixed towards SDG achievement or SDG attainment. I've mentioned this multiple times so that it should hammer and stick in the back of your minds in terms of understanding. Why did we launch an NDP 6 pack on Monday? Well, firstly, the NDPs are the small broken up pieces to achieve Vision 2030 for Namibia. And Namibia's Vision 2030 factors into or forms part of the SDG achievement by 2030. Just so that you know, it is literally in line with things. We are in line with an international setting. We're in line with it in order to achieve that international alignment. So Namibia knows what it has to do. But if I asked you, do you know what Namibia has to do with an international rules-based order, you'll go like, huh? What do you mean? What international rules-based order? I'll just ask you, do you know what it is? Who runs it? Who's in charge of it? When did Namibia sign on to an international rules-based order? And then no one would know. No one would be able to answer that question. Now, here's where things get interesting. Because at the heart of this particular discussion of the liberal international order, which is obviously identified by this particular academic, the gentleman's name is Andrew Latham, he cites, at the heart of this particular discussion of the liberal international order, which is the other name for the rules-based order, is that the project is driven by the United States. Hence the reason why you always see much of the NATO countries and much of the natural allies of the US, they always, you know, consult, have major meetings and engagements with the US in terms of, for example, if you look at the Munich Security Conference, if you look at the NATO Alliance Conference that took place a little bit earlier, I think that was end of May or June, The Munich Security Conference was in March. Yeah, it was in March. If you look at all these particular engagements and even the individual engagements that have taken place since Trump was inaugurated, of NATO member countries, you know, going to meet Donald Trump, you see a similar particular action, a similar particular body language, and a similar particular sort of like thread in terms of, okay, so you guys are all running to them instead of him visiting you guys for various particular engagements. And thus you sit with the idea of, okay, so it's a discussion primarily of, you know, we want to come and tell you that, you know, we still align with anything that America is trying to do. Now, naturally, in Southern Africa, that is what Southern Africa is following. We follow it in a, I don't want to say laissez-faire, because laissez-faire means like a we don't care scenario. But in Southern Africa, we follow it to a different scenario, to a different level. Why? Well, Southern Africa faces a specific weird position. There's an American congressperson or congressman or senator, one of the two, either from the Senate or from the Congress. Helmut and I, we spoke about it on the home run, specifically about the latest round of a bill being brought forward to sanction South Africa. Primarily because of the, you know, the ICC court case against Israel. Donald Trump, obviously, at the start of his particular tenure, his latest term, he obviously froze development aid to South Africa. First thing he did was freeze aid to South Africa as well. It was part of that USAID, you know, sort of like a freezing discussion. But South Africa got the largest chunk of that aid. South Africa got a large chunk of that aid. Not even Namibia saw the money that South Africa was getting. So South Africa got a lot of money. And South Africa later in this year is going to be hosting the G20 summit. And Donald Trump already said he doesn't want to attend the summit. Because obviously it looks weird. You know, you're allowing a senator, a local lawmaker there in your country to run through with a particular bill in order to sanction a country who's going to get who has the current G20 summit, the G20 presidency, who's going to host the summit later this year in November, I think, or is it in October? And this particular lawmaker is talking about sanctioning this country where other G20 summit members are firstly part of NATO, and they, secondly, they have similar particular trade relations with South Africa, just like you have as the US. And the US is going to get that particular presidency of the G20 next year. So many things are happening next year, actually, in the US. Next year, they're going to have the Football World Cup, FIFA Football World Cup. Is it next year or the year after that? They're going to have the Olympics. And there's something else also next year happening in the US, which will also have a major particular sort of like international appeal to it. But the G20 summit will be also part of that scenario. Now, the G20 summit is just one such particular international rules-based mechanism. Remember I told you it's the top 20 economies in the world. The G7 is the top 7 economies in the world minus Russia. G20, top 20 minus Russia. So, you sit with that particular indicator, you get the particular understanding of what the basis looks like, and you go, okay, so does it mean that all the rules come from America and the UK? Why did I throw in the UK there? I'll explain just now. Because here's the thing, dear listeners. If you go look at that, that Commonwealth Summit, the Commonwealth Summit or the Commonwealth is a pretty big cluster of countries. It's a massive cluster of countries. It spans from the Americas to Africa to Asia and to Oceania. The only country that's obviously not, that does not want to be part of the Commonwealth is the United States, because the Americans believe that they were not colonized. Well, tough luck for them. The important thing of this obviously speaks towards, why does an organization like the Commonwealth exist? Why does a collective of the Commonwealth exist? Now, the Commonwealth literally was a term that was used by the British whenever they needed soldiers out there in other parts of the world. And the actual British army from the UK couldn't respond quickly enough. So what happened? In the First World War, they used Australians and New Zealanders. In the Second World War, it was Australians, New Zealanders, South Africans. There were Namibians there. Because I think one of my siblings encountered a guy who indicated that his grandfather was a war veteran from the African chapter of the Second World War. So if you guys don't know, the Second World War, specifically in the European theater, began in two scenarios or in two phases. Firstly, it was the Battle of Dunkirk, or the Dunkirk offensive that took place by the British, the British and the French, and that's obviously how France quickly fell or capitulated in the defense of France, because Charles de Gaulle, who later on became president of France, took one half of the British Army, Navy, and Air Force, and went to Algeria. And the other half of that army was, unfortunately, they were too weak to technically, you know, resist and, you know, put up a good fight against the invading German army. And the British told them, listen, come with us and withdraw through Dunkirk. We withdraw back to the UK. And that's ultimately what happened. The second scenario was obviously the North African chapter, where, you know, the Allied nations first encountered the Axis nations. That was obviously Germany and Italy in North Africa. In that scenario, the British relied heavily on the Anzac soldiers. Anzacs are Australian and New Zealanders, but the British had Australian and Indian regiments fighting in Asia against the Japanese, and the British had to bring in New Zealander, South African, and there where there was a British presence in Africa, they brought through soldiers in that scenario. So that's also why you never hear of the Kenyan brigades, the Tanzanian brigades, the South African brigades, the Namibian brigades that fought in that particular Second World War scenario, because it wasn't spoken about. Because just go ask yourself a question, dear listeners. If you guys go to Swakopmund, the beach, or not at the beach, closer there to the lovely beachfront development of the hotel, the Strand Hotel, or Strand, because it's literally an Afrikaans word, you will find a German Second World War remembrance statue there. It's an unknown soldier statue there. But it has Second World War commemoration. That means it was Second World War Namibians, German Namibians, that fought in that combat. And you won't find a similar one for the ones that fought on the British side, obviously. Now, I know I took this long particular route to the aspect of lining out the Commonwealth discussion for you. Because in actual sense, that is the some of the particular basis that stems from the 1945 conflict or end of that particular conflict. So the idea, obviously, of this rules-based order system, which just hangs in the air and no one knows where it actually stems its power much from, even though we've now actually identified it, just for our particular understanding here in Namibia, is that the aim of this rules-based system is to avoid chaos. It's to avoid uncertainty. But you and I, we know where the uncertainty today is coming from. The uncertainty coming is coming from the same people who are saying stick to a rules-based order. The idea was to replace the chaos of power politics or great power politics and shifting alliances with a predictable world governed by shared rules and norms. Central to the vision is the establishment and was establishment, the, you know, because it was established, of institutions like the United Nations, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. And that these institutions, alongside widely accepted norms and formalized rules, aimed to promote political cooperation, peaceful resolution of disputes, and economic recovery for countries damaged by war. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. The vision of a truly universal liberal international order is quickly starting to unravel. I say quickly because it's still in the process of happening. As the Cold War had set in, the world split into two complete competing blocks. Hence the reason why you need to ask yourself is, whose rules do we have to play by? Whose rules are we actually adhering to? Now remember, I kept referencing to you a UN system. Namibia follows a UN system. We adhere to a UN-led system. We acknowledge a UN-led system. Anything else doesn't matter because Namibia is, yes, we're pretty good with it. And I mean, it's one of the things that we actually have to take our, you know, not just our political leaders in terms of, you know, sort of like acknowledging their, you know, steadfastness on this particular talking point is that you acknowledge the UN system. You stick to the UN system. Anything else is outside of that particular engagement. Anything else is outside of that scope. Anything else, we're on shaky grounds because then we'd have to renegotiate the neutral ground. And the neutral ground could be anyone's ground, in anyone's favor, in anyone's particular disadvantage. Now, obviously, as the Cold War split the world into two halves, the Western bloc led by the US adhered to the principles of liberal international order. Meanwhile, the Soviet-led communist bloc established a parallel system with its own norms, rules, and institutions. And I told you guys that that thing still exists in a way, in an essence. It still exists. It's known as the Commonwealth of Independent States. Now, the Warsaw Pact, if you don't know what the Warsaw Pact is literally the establishment of this particular indicator. Back in, I think it was the 70s or the 60s. And this pact provided military alignment, while the Council for Mutual Economic Assistance managed economic cooperation. Economic cooperation. Now, the communist bloc emphasized state-led economic planning and single-party rule, rejecting the liberal order's emphasis on democracy and free markets. So, we obviously know the particular train of thought that, you know, the trend that occurred from there. However, before we continue with our discussion this morning, dear listeners, we're going to take a short musical break and we're going to come back right after that.
Couldn't stand the rain, I will face every day.
Coming back there from the sounds of the Future Islands with the song The Fight. And obviously, we're still in the throes of this morning's particular discussion here on my Sunday morning take on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And just before we get back to where we left off, do remember, dear listeners, you can listen to us wherever, specifically based upon your particular, you know, preference with regards to how you wish to listen to us. You can download the Eagle FM app, which is free to download. It's really, it's a tiny, tiny download from either the Google Play Store or the Apple Store. And, there's also obviously the Eagle FM website that you can just Google search us through. Just remember, say Eagle FM Namibia. And then you can listen to your favorite broadcasts as well as also accessing some of your favorite podcasts, which is form part of our particular archival library. And lastly, to consult where you find yourself in the broader landscape of the country in terms of frequencies, there we always share, there's a frequency map on our socials. Consult that and have a look in terms of tuning into your favorite programming during the course of the day. Getting back where we left off, specifically in terms of identifying where the split, where the occurrence actually of this international rules-based discussion stems from and where it came from, is literally that much of it was actually galvanized and properly formed within the Cold War setting that obviously took place up and until 1989. Now, there are challenges in the contemporary context. Contemporary meaning today, relevant to the period of today. There are supposed challenges. They call it challenges. I mean, even this particular academic cites that supposedly this is a challenge. Actually, if you are part of the non-aligned movement, which is another international rules-based scenario, wow, would you look at that? There's a third one to stem from. Yes, if you look at this particular discussion from a Namibian perspective, or even from an AU perspective, or even from a SADC perspective, you're not taking a side in terms of whose particular underlying messaging you conform to. What am I saying? Well, here's the thing. This particular academic cites that the Belt and Road Initiative and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank are supposedly challenges. You can look at them as challenges, or you can look at them as someone exercising a particular right to start their own breakfast club in their own neighborhood and to talk to the people that they feel they want to talk to without having to talk to you, without having to consult with you. Remember when I said, dear listeners, at the start of the particular identification of certain particular factors and how, where this essence of this international rules-based order actually stems from, I mentioned to you the Commonwealth that Namibia is part of, right? And where you strategically have to go sit and think to yourself, why is Namibia part of this thing? Because the Americans are not part of it. But the Americans don't want to consider them to have been colonized. Well, they technically were. America was actually broken up into, was colonized by, three. We were colonized by three countries. Four, if you count what happened, who Alaska's previous owner was. Alaska was owned by Russia up until 19-something, just before the First World War. And then the Americans bought Alaska from the Russians. So, America, in essence, was owned by four major countries. Four major European countries. France, the British, or the, you know, the UK, the Spanish, and the Russians. So, even to consider anything as that America just popped out from nowhere in history, human history, is a lie. It's a lie. The Americans were also colonized. The Americans were also colonized. So, at the heart of our particular discussion that you need to look at here is the central question of whose definition of international rules-based order is being communicated the most. Because you will always hear this from NATO-affiliated countries. International rules-based order. What international rules? Whose international rules? You're not even saying international law. You're just saying rules. What rules? Abide by what? Are you talking about UN Charter? Or are you talking about NATO affiliation? Or NATO preferences? Because I'll tell you what the international rules-based order is currently leading us into. Here is the weirdest of the weird. This past week, I watched a particular, it was a short sort of like extended report about Germany's, reinvestment into their country. Now, many Namibians obviously are still partially puzzled by, you know, the green hydrogen investment. Are still partially puzzled by this rapid investment into renewable energy. Are still puzzled by, you know, why are we seeing this whole discussion about renewable energy being at the forefront of everything? And many Namibians don't see the long play. I know, guys, there's nothing wrong because you have more pertinent issues to concentrate on in your daily lives. I know, I do the same thing, but I'm sort of like someone that walks around with split personalities every day because, you know, for work-based scenarios, I have to think about, you know, and look at and analyze what the long play is for certain things that are coming out in recent weeks. And then obviously you have to think about your immediate particular, you know, emergencies and aspects in your daily life and, you know, family and all that kind of stuff and, requirements and conditions that are placed upon you in other scenarios in your personal space or in your personal life. I know. We're all human. But factor in you being a human with regards to what AI is trying to do. And then you go like, oh, okay, so they're trying to take jobs or they're trying to remove certain jobs from the job market, which are deemed as entry-level jobs, in order for certain people, particularly to, you know, sort of like reskilled or repurposed in other aspects of an economy. Now, I'm not an AI trend here. I'm just factoring that in because we're looking at the next 10 years. Where you are going to look at specifically is this green energy discussion. Now, Europe, or let me focus, become even more focused, Germany, they've already put aside a 500 billion euro fund to firstly reinvest in Germany's infrastructure. This is all Germany's infrastructure. But they've got a huge problem. They need manpower. Part of that was the reason as to why they had the elections back in February this year, which saw the CDU-CSU party, which was the party of the former Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, come back into power. Obviously, bumping off the previous coalition to establish a new coalition, which included two elements of the previous coalition. The only party that obviously lost out was the, the left party. Yeah, the left party. They're the yellow guys. They were known as the traffic light coalition, supposedly. So you still have Olaf Scholz's party, the SPD. You still have the Green Party, which has the number two, which is the president, the vice chancellor that came here to Namibia. What's the guy's name? Robert Habeck, his party. You still have those guys there in power. And you obviously saw a big rise in the AfD, which is deemed as a right-wing party in Germany and in Europe, specifically, we still have to understand where those guys stand in terms of Germany's relations with Namibia, but that party is against specifically, you know, in a Namibian context, they don't like the genocide discussion or even the joint declaration discussion with Namibia. They don't want to deal with that because they've been asked this particular question supposedly and, supposedly because obviously, you know, I can't find the materials in English. Not that they've been written in Afrikaans even, because predominantly it would be in German about this particular aspect where they possibly said no. They don't believe that Germany should try and acknowledge any harm or damage that they caused during the genocide, Namibia's genocide. So first off, there is a major threat to Namibian internal in relations if that party in the next 10 years becomes the dominant party in Germany. There is a threat. So I'm setting the scene for you to understand this particular threat. The second particular level of understanding whose rules of international, of the international order should we abide by if it's just a vague statement that's being made. And that's the same particular vague statement that the UK Parliament literature resource that I've got here also outlines. It's a vague statement. Whose international rules are we playing by? Who is the setter? Who's the rule setter and who are the rule takers? Namibia is already a rule taker. We already take rules from the UN, as I mentioned earlier. But who's the rule setter? What do they want? Democracy? Okay, what does democracy look like? I mean, we've already got the word republic in our name. Republic means, you know, there's an aspect of identifying each individual's rights collectively. It's not a vague statement of democracy. Rights. If you go look up, guys, what the difference is between a republic and the word democracy is. Because if you say republic, you don't obviously want to sit with the double, what do they call that thing? The double pronunciation in the DRC's name. Democratic Republic. I don't know why they had to use democratic. Or like what North Korea's actual official name is. The Democratic People's Republic of Korea. I also don't understand that. It more looked like a pun. It looks more like a pun than it actually looks like being republic or being a republic. Because republic means that you've got representatives that represent the masses. And North Korea is far from being democratic and even being a republic in its own right. Because we don't know if they even have elections in that country. We don't even know that. However, slight digression there. So, when you obviously look at the emergence of the Belt and Road Initiative and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, obviously as China's efforts are identified in order to establish alternative frameworks, which are more aligned with its interests, here's the particular thing. Go to the discussion that we had about, that came through last year about the Forum for China-Africa Cooperation, FORCAC. In that particular discussion itself, you understand the basis as to what feeds into the Belt and Road Initiative and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank discussions in terms of, you know what, these are countries that would have shared interest in terms of continued cooperation, positive and friendly international relations, that there is no, you were the former colonizer of me, now I sit here with Stockholm syndrome and I have to recognize your particular importance in terms of still being present in my everyday affairs as now being a sovereign country, because it looks a little bit weird. It looks weird. Look, there's nothing we can do about South Africa. There's nothing. However, it looks weird in a UK sense. It also looks weird in a Germany sense. And it looks even weirder, for example, in a very lopsided way if you try to look at an American context. There is one particular sort of nice indicator that was outlined specifically in terms of the recent developments. Now, ever since the particular Ukraine conflict, obviously that stemmed from 2014, according to this academic, the challenge to the order's core principles of sovereignty and territorial integrity was obviously put to the test and is one of the largest particular known pressure points, which is something you can also say in terms of the invasion of Iraq, as well as also the invasion of Afghanistan. But yay, no one remembers that, supposedly. Now, he cites that Western inconsistencies have long undermined the credibility of the rules-based order. Indeed, I just referenced to you two, Iraq and Afghanistan, because the 2003 US-led invasion of Iraq, widely criticized for bypassing international norms and institutions, and even international law. Yes, international law. There's literally a law that exists on the measures that countries have to take in order to avert the ultimate negative, which is all-out war with each other. Meaning, engage multilateral platforms in terms of dialogue. political engagement, in terms of seeking some sort of a compromise, the aspect is that you always have to seek a compromise before you go into pure conflict. The last thing you should ever reach is conflict, which is literally the same ethos that The Art of War by Sun Tzu espouses. Do not aim for all-out conflict. Aim literally for, use other means for conflict, which don't speak to any kind of battlefield, but rather predominantly just avoid open conflict. Avoid it. Now, this double standard extends towards Washington's selective engagement with international legal bodies and its inconsistent approach to sovereignty and intervention. When you obviously look towards the future of things, some people have argued, which are pro the rules-based system, or international rules-based system, that the rules-based order remains vital for addressing global challenges such as climate change, pandemics, and nuclear proliferation. But once again, put them in order. Climate change, pandemics, and nuclear proliferation all have sub-entities affiliated to the UN. So that means there's a UN system to follow. Not anyone else's system. A UN system. Why? Because it's not just the US and the UK and France on the Security Council. There's China and Russia as well. So at least you know they support the aspect of the UN in its existence. But then there's another particular sort of, like, if I could call it like a discrediting dimension. Ambiguity surrounds what these rules actually are, entail, mean, look like, materialize as, or even take form as, or manifest in. Because which norms are genuinely universal? And who enforces these particular norms? The lack of clarity, coupled with shifting global power dynamics, complicates efforts to sustain the system, which it does. Which is the scene? Which is the setting? The future of a rules-based international order is actually uncertain. It has always been uncertain. It was even worse during the Cold War era because you literally had three sides splitting away. The massively growing non-aligned movement, which said, guys, I really don't see myself in either one of your camps because both your camps don't like each other. So whether or not one of you actually ceased to exist as a camp in its own right, I will be treated with mistrust by the opposite camp of this camp that I potentially join. Thus, you had countries that decided to go and establish the non-aligned movement. Go look it up, guys. The non-aligned movement is a wonderful thing to read about. Namibia acknowledges it. We like it. We like it. The whole of Africa is in that non-aligned movement. The whole of Africa. Now, the future of the rules-based international order, as mentioned, is uncertain. The shift from liberal to rules-based reflected an ongoing struggle to adapt a complex web of rules. Because it is too complex. I have to go look up something there which speaks to here, but the first particular item that it's mentioned here doesn't reference that item over there, and that constitution over there, or that founding statement over there, or this particular mission and vision statement over here. Nothing ties to nothing. Because people walk around making up things, obviously, as they go about, and, you know, from year to year. So, it obviously makes it difficult to struggle or difficult to adapt to a complex web of rules, norms, and institutions to a rapidly changing international environment. Now, whether it evolves further or splinters or endures, as is, will depend on how well it balances fairness, inclusivity, and stability in an increasingly multipolar world. So, it sets the scene on one side. Because when I say it sets the scene on one side, you have to understand is, once again, whose rules do you play by? Whose rules do you participate in? Whose rules do you acknowledge? Now, there was a lovely explainer also done by the, as I mentioned, the British Parliament. This is kept in their library. It's an explainer about the challenges to the rules-based order, because you have to understand what further on, you know, who interprets, how does every party interpret this rules-based order? Now, this is what the British had here, is that the concept of a rules-based international order is broadly understood to mean the framework of political, legal, and economic rules established following the Second World War. Now, legal is associated to the UN because there are laws there, or charters, or a set of rules. No, not rules. Rules are too loose of a term. But as a set of laws, international laws, in the UN charter that establishes international law. And Namibia subscribes to that. You see the exercise that I'm doing? I can indicate to you, Namibia subscribes to that thing. Namibia doesn't subscribe to a loose-knit somewhere kind of a bilateral agreement in terms of saying you exclusively only have to listen to us over here versus listening to the UN system. We're actually a staunch supporter of the UN system as Namibia. We're actually a staunch, massively staunch supporter of it. But yeah. So, they indicate the explainer here from the former US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, who described it as a system of laws, agreements, principles, and institutions that the world came together on to build after two world wars, to manage relations between states, to prevent conflict, to uphold the rights of all people. However, they also cite another particular academic, one John Ikenberry, who says that this is actually a multi-layered model. It's a model. So the model consists of component parts, multiple aspects that exist in an unknown, unidentified ecosystem. Saying, which is based on environmental conditions, international commitments, and the principle of national sovereignty and self-determination. Meaning, open rule-based order is a set of commitments to states, or by states, to operate according to principles, rules, and institutions that provide governance that is not simply dictated by who is most powerful. Yeah, no. So, it's a set of environmental conditions for doing business, contracts, multilateral institutions, and it comes in many layers. And at the deepest level, it's really the system of sovereignty. It's the belief that the world is a kind of foundation built around self-determined states that respect each other. But, there's further to add on to this particular understanding. These layers of treaties and institutions arguably culminate in the UN system, building rules and principles around aspirations for the inclusions of all peoples and societies. On top of that, sit the more work-oriented rules and institutions that came out of the Second World War based on problem-solving and regulating interdependence, such as the IMF and the World Bank and the WHO, but that specifically the rules-based order has also, or also does have a kind of a Western liberal democracy component to it, on top of those more basic fundamental institutions, sovereignty and global multilateralism. And there's always a caveat Because the interesting thing to acknowledge here is that although the relative peace that the world has enjoyed since the end of the Second World War has been reinforced by international norms and treaties, the shorthand assumption is that there is a single universally acknowledged order, or that the world is now divided between those who obey the rules, meaning ourselves, he was speaking about themselves, the British, and those who do not, the others, has always been an oversimplification. Meaning, to say that there is, you know, that this thing exists, we can somehow see it, it's somewhat tangible, and that there are, you know, the camp that acknowledges and tries to follow it, and the camp that supposedly, put it in inverted commas, that does not follow it nor acknowledge it, is an oversimplification, meaning that it sounds too one-dimensional. Because he explains, this is now this Ekenberry, for the UK and other Western states, the challenge should not be whether they are in favor of the rules-based system, but rather it lies in identifying how rules-based systems can be used to help pursue national interests and values, including whether these need to be developed or replaced as circumstances change. So, the setting is obviously not clear. Sorry, it was not Ekenberry that made that statement. It was actually another particular academic by the name of Malcolm Chalmers. Because he also noted that there's an aspect of power-based bargains that actually exist. Now, when I say power-based bargains, look at what Donald Trump is doing. He's using American power to get the way, to get the political way for the political policies that he wants to introduce, not just in the US, but also to countries that have been dealing with the US for most of human history. And one of them, obviously, is South Africa. And one of them, obviously, is another one is obviously also the whole of the African continent as well. Because if you guys did not know or did not hear, there was a whole bunch of African presidents that went to Trump 2 weeks back. And it was in relation to the Americans negotiating with these African countries to take some of the deportees. And these deportees are criminals, hardened criminals. Now, I ask you, guys, international rules-based system says, or dictates, you don't ship people that are not from a country to another country. But here's the saddest thing of this particular scenario that I'm describing to you. The home country of these criminals have said that they don't want these guys back. They don't want them back. If you're a Namibian, you commit a crime in the US. But the Namibian police here in Namibia knew that you were a criminal. And you obviously found your way somehow to the US. And the US now tells Namibia, hey Namibia, come take your person back. Here he is. We caught him. He committed this particular crime. Please take him back. We don't want him. Because he's not American. And Namibia says, no, we don't want that guy back. Firstly, it actually spells that you are stripped of your citizenship. Because that is very humiliating. And secondly, since you became stateless now, or somehow, the US can ship you wherever. It could possibly even mean that they can ship you to the North Pole if they want to, so that the polar bears can chase you around. And that they don't have to pay for you. But you know what? There's something known as international human rights recognition that needs to be upheld. So, they negotiate with other countries, African countries sometimes. Apparently, Sudan, of all countries, got like 20 or 50 people in the past 6 months. And they're not even African, some of these guys. They're like hardened criminals. And this is ultimately what's going on there in the American context, specifically because this is as now people are being deported out of the U.S., that have overstayed their welcome. Now, obviously, I am highlighting to you something of international immigration and migrationary scenarios. The difference of our particular discussion, obviously, is that the international rules-based system speaks towards a supportive system, a supportive base for immigrants and migrants and people that are running away from persecution and war and famine and other particular things that are putting their lives in threat or that are a threat to their lives. And here you've got the Americans deporting people to third countries, not even the home country of that, of those people, of the people being deported, which makes things weird. And then they go and open up immigration, active immigration for people from a country that is not at war. I'm not talking obviously about the, you know, the white South Africans that, you know, listed themselves as some sort of a refugee. But refugees from active conflict zones have not been, you know, the border is closed. The American border is closed to them. Which also explains to you, what does this international rules-based order speak towards? Is it based upon US President to US President's own interpretation with their own policies regarding how the US positions itself in the world? Because guess what has happened in the last 6 months or 4 months in terms of Donald Trump's presidency? Is that the American tourist market has crashed. It has crashed. Let me say it again. The American tourism market is busy crashing. I'll say it again. The American tourism market is busy crashing. I'll say it again. The American tourism market is busy crashing. Why? It's not because major European countries and other countries have placed, what do they call it, travel warnings on their citizens traveling to the US. They've actually indicated to their citizens, there's nothing we can do if you show up there at an international airport in the US and the ICE, the immigration officials of the US, take you into custody. And they hold you in custody for as long as you were planning on being in the US. And then they release you. Now, what kind of a holiday is that? What kind of a respect system is that for citizens from one country visiting another country? Remember the principle that our former Minister of Home Affairs, Albert Kawana, emphasized, motivated, as thus also explained extensively, not just to lawmakers in the National Assembly, because here's one of the funny things, is that the opposition parties, none of them understood the tourism market. None of them. They were partially asking a question. Partially. But none of them still, till this day, understand the value that the tourism market can play for the overall upliftment of the everyday Namibian and for Namibians living in rural areas of this country. They still don't understand it. Yes, having food in your belly is very important. But in many cases, people want a job that adds meaning to their lives, because you've got to look at it as past just the food in the belly concept. Then, because then it means we can all just open up soup kitchens and, and what's the thing's name? And food banks. Right? Right. So when you look at it in that scenario, Kawana was the only one explaining, specifically from an international relations perspective, how the Namibian tourist or the Namibian flying out of Namibia, which is a very small minority, mind you. That's a very small minority of Namibians. And I'm not talking about flying to another African country. I'm talking about flying to outside of the African continent, specifically to Europe and to North America. How that Namibian is treated. That Namibian has to pay an exorbitant amount of money because now the Americans have placed a $250 visa fee for a visa. A visa. When you come to Namibia, when you come to the US, a visa, $250. You know how much is $250? Listeners, 5,000 Namibian dollars. So it's 5,000 Namibian dollars to pay for a visa. Now, apparently, the visa is sort of like an insurance policy. If you come to the US, you overstay your welcome. You get deported. That money is used in the facilitation of deporting you. But if you stay within the allotted period, which is usually 3 months in terms of what I've seen in terms of the normative functions of, you know, a tourist visa. It's a 3 month period. If you stay within the 3 month period and you exit out of the US in that 3 month period, you get your money back. You get your $250 back. Your $5,000. You get it back. Just like that. It's an insurance policy. In the case that you overstay your welcome. Now, what I just explained to you sounds, you would go, okay, that sounds understandable. That sounds decent. And then in essence, you then go and ask the next natural question is like, okay, so how much does it cost in Namibia? And I'll tell you that it costs below 2,000 Namibian dollars for that tourist visa. Below 2,000 Namibian dollars. And that below the 2,000 Namibian dollar mark, Namibia is still seeing a large influx of tourists coming to it. Why? Okay, firstly, we're pretty open in terms of our discussion, in terms of when that e-visa system came along. It made it a very accessible for this, for many tourists in the world to apply to Namibia. It makes it very accessible. Highly accessible. So when you look at this particular position, this particular aspect in terms of this tourism market discussion, the international rules-based system, yes, it doesn't say anything towards the tourism market. It doesn't speak anything towards ultimately what is to be expected. However, it literally does speak towards the ability for countries to actually have peaceful coexistence or peaceful, relations with each other. But then the peaceful relations is based upon whose rules? Whose rules do we follow? Can I live by my rules and you live by your rules? Or do we first need to establish the playing field between each other? We'll quickly take a musical break, dear listeners, and we come back right after that, as we are battling very, very, very quickly towards the top of the hour at 7 a.m. We'll be back after that. And obviously, we'll be, heading into sort of like the last leg of this morning's discussion here in your number one talk radio station. This is my Sunday Morning Take, and you are on Eagle FM.
never had a place to call my own, and slept so many nights out all alone. I spent so many hours slowly breaking in, and finally found someone who let me in. But if I said too much, please let me know. It wouldn't be the first time I've been told. I got the stock in town, found this bitter cold. Needed a little light to follow home. I tiptoed past the lights, I hit the glow. Another silent night, found no one home. This bric-a-brac has life, that someone knows. A bitter path of life that I've been shown. So I sit on my hands now, sit on my hands now, sit on my hands now.
Closer there to the lovely beachfront development of the hotel, the Strand Hotel, or Strand, because it's literally an Afrikaans word. You will find a German Second World War remembrance statue there. It's an unknown soldier statue there. But it has Second World War commemoration. That means it was Second World War Namibians, German Namibians, that fought in that combat. And you won't find a similar one for the ones that fought on the British side, obviously. Now, I know I took this long particular route to the aspect of lining out the Commonwealth discussion for you, because in actual sense, that is some of the particular basis that stems from the 1945 conflict, or end of that particular conflict. So, the idea, obviously, of this rules-based order system which just hangs there in the air and no one knows where it actually stems its power much from, even though we've now actually identified it just for our particular understanding here in Namibia, is that the aim of this rules-based system is to avoid chaos. It's to avoid uncertainty. But you and I, we know where the uncertainty today is coming from. The uncertainty is coming from the same people who are saying stick to a rules-based order. The idea was to replace the chaos of power politics, or great power politics, and shifting alliances with a predictable world governed by shared rules and norms. Central to the vision is the establishment and was establishment, the, you know, because it was established, of institutions like the United Nations, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. And that these institutions, alongside widely accepted norms and formalized rules, aimed to promote political cooperation, peaceful resolution of disputes, and economic recovery for countries damaged by war. But here's the thing. The vision of a truly universal liberal international order is quickly starting to unravel. I say quickly, because it's still in the process of happening. As the Cold War had set in, the world split into two complete competing blocks. Hence the reason why you need to ask yourself is, whose rules do we have to play by? Whose rules are we actually adhering to? Now remember, I kept referencing to you a UN system. Namibia follows a UN system. We adhere to a UN-led system. We acknowledge a UN-led system. Anything else doesn't matter because Namibia is, yes, we're pretty good with it. And I mean, it's one of the things that we actually have to take our, you know, not just our political leaders in terms of, you know, sort of like acknowledging their, you know, steadfastness on this particular talking point is that you acknowledge the UN system. You stick to the UN system. Anything else is outside of that particular engagement. Anything else is outside of that scope. Anything else, we're on shaky grounds because then we'd have to renegotiate the neutral ground. And the neutral ground could be anyone's ground, in anyone's favor, in anyone's particular disadvantage. Now, obviously, as the Cold War split the world into two halves, the Western bloc led by the US adhered to the principles of liberal international order. Meanwhile, the Soviet-led communist bloc established a parallel system with its own norms, rules, and institutions. And I told you guys that thing still exists in a way, in an essence. It still exists. It's known as the Commonwealth of Independent States. Now, the Warsaw Pact, if you don't know what the Warsaw Pact is literally the establishment of this particular indicator back in, I think it was the 70s or the 60s. And this pact provided military alignment, while the Council for Mutual Economic Assistance managed economic cooperation. Economic cooperation. Now, the communist bloc emphasized state-led economic planning and single-party rule, rejecting the liberal order's emphasis on democracy and free markets. So, we obviously know the particular train of thought that, you know, the trend that occurred from there. However, before we continue with our discussion this morning, dear listeners, we're going to take a short musical break and we're going to come back right after that.
I will face every day. Cause in this house, and I will keep you safe, just like our past was. Fight for love.
Coming back there from the sounds of the Future Islands with the song The Fight. And obviously, we're still in the throes of this morning's particular discussion here on my Sunday morning take on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And just before we get back to where we left off, do remember, dear listeners, you can listen to us wherever, wherever, specifically based upon your particular, you know, preference with regards to how you wish to listen to us. You can download the Eagle FM app, which is free to download. It's really, it's a tiny, tiny download from either the Google Play Store or the Apple Store. And, there's also obviously the Eagle FM website that you can just Google search us through. Just remember, say Eagle FM Namibia. And then you can listen to your favorite broadcasts as well as also accessing some of your favorite podcasts, which is form part of our particular archival library. And lastly, to consult where you find yourself in the broader landscape of the country in terms of frequencies, there we always share, there's a frequency map on our socials. Consult that and have a look in terms of tuning into your favorite programming during the course of the day. Getting back where we left off, specifically in terms of identifying where the split, where the occurrence actually of this international rules-based discussion stems from and where it came from, is literally that much of it was actually galvanized and properly formed within the Cold War setting that obviously took place up and until 1989. Now, there are challenges in the contemporary context. Contemporary meaning today, relevant to the period of today. There are supposed challenges. They call it challenges. I mean, even this particular academic cites that supposedly this is a challenge. Actually, if you are part of the non-aligned movement, which is another international rules-based scenario, wow, would you look at that? There's a third one to stem from. Yes, if you look at this particular discussion from a Namibian perspective, or even from an AU perspective, or even from a SADC perspective, you're not taking a side in terms of whose particular underlying messaging you conform to. What am I saying? Well, here's the thing. This particular academic cites that the Belt and Road Initiative and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank are supposedly challenges. You can look at them as challenges, or you can look at them as someone exercising a particular right to start their own breakfast club in their own neighborhood and to talk to the people that they feel they want to talk to without having to talk to you, without having to consult with you. Remember when I said, dear listeners, at the start of the particular identification of certain particular factors and how, where this essence of this international rules-based order actually stems from, I mentioned to you the Commonwealth that Namibia is part of, right? And where you strategically have to go sit and think to yourself, why is Namibia part of this thing? Because the Americans are not part of it, but the Americans don't want to consider them to have been colonized. Well, they technically were. America was actually broken up into, was colonized by, We were colonized by three countries. Four, if you count what happened, who Alaska's previous owner was. Alaska was owned by Russia up until 19-something, just before the First World War. And then they bought, the Americans bought Alaska from the Russians. So, America, in essence, was owned by four major countries. Four major European countries. France, the British, or the, you know, the UK, the Spanish, and the Russians. So, even to consider anything as that America just popped out from nowhere in history, human history, is a lie. It's a lie. The Americans were also colonized. The Americans were also colonized. So, at the heart of our particular discussion that you need to look at here is the central question of whose definition of international rules-based order is being communicated the most. Because you will always hear this from NATO-affiliated countries. International rules-based order. What international rules? Whose international rules? You're not even saying international law. You're just saying rules. What rules? Abide by what? Are you talking about UN Charter? Or are you talking about NATO affiliation? Or NATO preferences? Because I'll tell you what the international rules-based order is currently leading us into. Here is the weirdest of the weird. This past week, I watched a particular, it was a short sort of like extended report about Germany's, reinvestment into their country. Now, many Namibians obviously are still partially puzzled by, you know, the green hydrogen investment. Are still partially puzzled by this rapid investment into renewable energy. Are still puzzled by, you know, why are we seeing this whole discussion about renewable energy being at the forefront of everything. And many Namibians don't see the long play. I know, guys, there's nothing wrong because you have more pertinent issues to concentrate on in your daily lives. I know, I do the same thing, but I'm sort of like someone that walks around with split personalities every day because, you know, for work-based scenarios, I have to think about, you know, and look at and analyze what the long play is for certain things that are coming out. in recent weeks. And then obviously you have to think about your immediate particular, you know, emergencies and aspects in your daily life and, you know, family and all that kind of stuff and, requirements and conditions that are placed upon you in other scenarios in your personal space or in your personal life. I know. We're all human. But factor in you being a human with regards to what AI is trying to do. And then you go like, oh, okay, so they're trying to take jobs or they're trying to remove certain jobs from the job market, which are deemed as entry-level jobs, in order for certain people, particularly, to, you know, sort of like reskilled or repurposed in other aspects of an economy. Now, I'm not an AI trend here. I'm just factoring that in because we're looking at the next 10 years. Where you are going to look at specifically is this green energy discussion. Now, Europe, or let me focus, become even more focused, Germany, they've already put aside a 500 billion euro fund to firstly reinvest in Germany's infrastructure. This is all Germany's infrastructure. But they've got a huge problem. They need manpower. Part of that was the reason as to why they had the elections back in February this year, which saw the CDU-CSU party, which was the party of the former Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, come back into power. Obviously, bumping off the previous coalition to establish a new coalition, which included two elements of the previous coalition. The only party that obviously lost out was the, the left party. Yeah, the left party. They're the yellow guys. They were known as the traffic light coalition, supposedly. So you still have Olaf Scholz's party, the SPD. You still have the Green Party, which has the number two, which is the president, the vice chancellor that came here to Namibia. What's the guy's name? Robert Habeck, his party. You still have those guys there in power. And you obviously saw a big rise in the AfD, which is deemed as a right-wing party in Germany and in Europe, specifically, we still have to understand where those guys stand in terms of Germany's relations with Namibia, but that party is against specifically, you know, in a Namibian context, they don't like the genocide discussion or even the joint declaration discussion with Namibia. They don't want to deal with that. Because they've been asked this particular question supposedly, and, supposedly, because obviously, you know, I can't find the materials in English. Not that they've been written in Afrikaans even, because predominantly it would be in German. About this particular aspect where they possibly said no. They don't believe that Germany should try and acknowledge any harm or damage that they caused during the genocide, Namibia's genocide. So first off, there is a major threat to Namibian internal in relations if that party in the next 10 years becomes the dominant party in Germany. There is a threat. So I'm setting the scene for you to understand this particular threat. The second particular level of understanding whose rules of international, of the international order should we abide by if it's just a vague statement that's being made. And that's the same particular vague statement that the UK Parliament literature resource that I've got here also outlines. It's a vague statement. Whose international rules are we playing by? Who is the setter? Who's the rule setter and who are the rule takers? Namibia is already a rule taker. We already take rules from the UN, as I mentioned earlier. But who's the rule setter? What do they want? Democracy? Okay, what does democracy look like? I mean, we've already got the word republic in our name. Republic means, you know, there's an aspect of identifying each individual's rights collectively. It's not a vague statement of democracy. Rights. If you go look up, guys, what the difference is between a republic and the word democracy is. Because if you say republic, you don't obviously want to sit with the double, what do they call that thing? The double pronunciation in the DRC's name. Democratic Republic. I don't know why they had to use democratic. Or like what North Korea's actual official name is. The Democratic People's Republic of Korea. I don't understand that. It more looked like a pun. It looks more like a pun than it actually looks like being a republic. Or being a republic. Because a republic means that you've got representatives that represent the masses. And North Korea is far from being democratic and even being a republic in its own right. Because we don't know if they even have elections in that country. We don't even know that. However, slight digression there. So, when you obviously look at the emergence of the Belt and Road Initiative and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, obviously as China's efforts are identified in order to establish alternative frameworks, which are more aligned with its interests. Here's the particular thing. Go to the discussion that came through last year about the Forum for China-Africa Cooperation, FORCAC. In that particular discussion itself, you understand the basis as to what feeds into the Belt and Road Initiative and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank discussions in terms of, you know what, these are countries that would have shared interest in terms of continued cooperation, positive and friendly international relations, that there is no, you were the former colonizer of me, now I sit here with Stockholm syndrome and I have to recognize your particular importance in terms of still being present in my everyday affairs as now being a sovereign country, because it looks a little bit weird. It looks weird. Look, there's nothing we can do about South Africa. There's nothing. However, it looks weird in a UK sense. It also looks weird in a Germany sense. And it looks even weirder, for example, in a very lopsided way, if you try to look at an American context. There is one particular sort of nice indicator that was outlined specifically in terms of the recent developments. Now, ever since the particular Ukraine conflict, obviously that stemmed from 2014, according to this academic, the challenge to the order's core principles of sovereignty and territorial integrity was obviously put to the test and is one of the largest particular known pressure points, which is something you can also say in terms of the invasion of Iraq, as well as also the invasion of Afghanistan. But yay, no one remembers that, supposedly. Now, he cites that Western inconsistencies have long undermined the credibility of the rules-based order. Indeed, I just referenced to you two, Iraq and Afghanistan, because the 2003 US-led invasion of Iraq, widely criticized for bypassing international norms and institutions, and even international law. Yes, international law. There's literally a law that exists on the measures that countries have to take in order to avert the ultimate negative, which is all-out war with each other. Meaning, engage multilateral platforms in terms of dialogue, political engagement, in terms of seeking some sort of a compromise, the aspect is that you always have to seek a compromise before you go into pure conflict. The last thing you should ever reach is conflict, which is literally the same ethos that The Art of War by Sun Tzu espouses. Do not aim for all-out conflict. Aim literally for, use other means for conflict which don't speak to any kind of battlefield, but rather predominantly just avoid open conflict. Avoid it. Now, this double standard extends towards Washington's selective engagement with international legal bodies and its inconsistent approach to sovereignty and intervention. When you obviously look towards the future of things, some people have argued, which are pro the rules-based system, or international rules-based system, that the rules-based order remains vital for addressing global challenges such as climate change, pandemics, and nuclear proliferation. But once again, put them in order. Climate change, pandemics, and nuclear proliferation all have sub-entities affiliated to the UN. So that means there's a UN system to follow. Not anyone else's system. A UN system. Why? Because it's not just the US and the UK and France on the Security Council. There's China and Russia as well. So at least you know they support the aspect of the UN in its existence. But then there's another particular sort of, like, if I could call it like a discrediting dimension. Ambiguity surrounds what these rules actually are, entail, mean, look like, materialize as, or even take form as, or manifest in. Because which norms are genuinely universal? And who enforces these particular norms? The lack of clarity, coupled with shifting global power dynamics, complicates efforts to sustain the system. Which it does. Which is the scene? Which is the setting? The future of a rules-based international order is actually uncertain. It has always been uncertain. It was even worse during the Cold War era because you literally had three sides splitting away. The massively growing non-aligned movement, which said, guys, I really don't see myself in either one of your camps because both your camps don't like each other. So whether or not one of you actually ceased to exist as a camp in its own right, I will be treated with mistrust by the opposite camp of this camp that I potentially join. Thus, you had countries that decided to go and establish the non-aligned movement. Go look it up, guys. The non-aligned movement is a wonderful thing to read about. Namibia acknowledges it. We like it. We like it. The whole of Africa is in that non-aligned movement. The whole of Africa. Now, the future of the rules-based international order, as mentioned, is uncertain. The shift from liberal to rules-based reflected an ongoing struggle to adapt a complex web of rules. Because it is too complex. I have to go look up something there, which speaks to here, but the first particular item that it's mentioned here doesn't reference that item over there, and that constitution over there, or that founding statement over there, or this particular mission and vision statement over here, nothing ties to nothing. Because people walk around making up things, obviously, as they go about, and, you know, from year to year. So, it obviously makes it difficult to struggle, or difficult to adapt to a complex web of rules, norms, and institutions to a rapidly changing international environment. Now, whether it evolves further, or splinters, or endures, as is, will depend on how well it balances fairness, inclusivity, and stability in an increasingly multipolar world. So, it sets the scene on one side. Because when I say it sets the scene on one side, you have to understand is, once again, whose rules do you play by? Whose rules do you participate in? Whose rules do you acknowledge? Now, there was a lovely explainer also done by the, as I mentioned, the British Parliament. This is kept in their library. It's an explainer about the challenges to the rules-based order, because you have to understand what further on, you know, who interprets, how does every party interpret this rules-based order? Now, this is what the British had here, is that the concept of a rules-based international order is broadly understood to mean the framework of political, legal, and economic rules established following the Second World War. Now, legal is associated to the UN because there are laws there, or charters, or a set of rules. No, not rules. Rules are too loose of a term. But as a set of laws, international laws, in the UN charter that establishes international law. And Namibia subscribes to that. You see the exercise that I'm doing? I can indicate to you, Namibia subscribes to that thing. Namibia doesn't subscribe to a loose-knit somewhere kind of a bilateral agreement in terms of saying, you exclusively only have to listen to us over here versus listening to the UN system. We're actually a staunch supporter of the UN system as Namibia. We're actually a staunch, massively staunch supporter of it. But yeah. So, they indicate the explainer here from the former US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, who described it as a system of laws, agreements, principles, and institutions that the world came together on to build after two world wars, to manage relations between states, to prevent conflict, to uphold the rights of all people. However, they also cite another particular academic, one John Eikenberry, who says that this is actually a multi-layered model. It's a model. So the model consists of component parts, multiple aspects that exist in an unknown, unidentified ecosystem. Saying, which is based on environmental conditions, international commitments, and the principle of national sovereignty and self-determination. Meaning, open rule-based order is a set of commitments to states, or by states, to operate according to principles, rules, and institutions that provide governance that is not simply dictated by who is most powerful. Yeah, no. So, it's a set of environmental conditions for doing business, contracts, multilateral institutions, and it comes in many layers. And at the deepest level, it's really the system of sovereignty. It's the belief that the world is a kind of foundation built around self-determined states that respect each other. But, there's further to add on to this particular understanding. These layers of treaties and institutions arguably culminate in the UN system, building rules and principles around aspirations for the inclusions of all peoples and societies. On top of that, sit the more work-oriented rules and institutions that came out of the Second World War based on problem-solving and regulating interdependence, such as the IMF and the World Bank and the WHO. But that specifically the rules-based order has also, or also does have a kind of a Western liberal democracy component to it, on top of those more basic fundamental institutions, sovereignty and global multilateralism. And there's always a caveat, because the interesting thing to acknowledge here is that Although the relative peace that the world has enjoyed since the end of the Second World War has been reinforced by international norms and treaties, the shorthand assumption is that there is a single universally acknowledged order, or that the world is now divided between those who obey the rules, meaning ourselves, he was speaking about themselves, the British, and those who do not, the others, has always been an oversimplification. Meaning, to say that there is, you know, that this thing exists, we can somehow see it, it's somewhat tangible, and that there are, you know, the camp that acknowledges and tries to follow it, and the camp that supposedly, put it in inverted commas, that does not follow it nor acknowledge it, is an oversimplification, meaning that it sounds too one-dimensional. Because he explains, this is now this Eikenberry, for the UK and other Western states, the challenge should not be whether they are in favor of the rules-based system, but rather it lies in identifying how rules-based systems can be used to help pursue national interests and values, including whether these need to be developed or replaced as circumstances change. So, the setting is obviously not clear. Sorry, it was not Eikenberry that made that statement. It was actually another particular academic by the name of Malcolm Chalmers. Because he also noted that there's an aspect of power-based bargains that actually exist. Now, when I say power-based bargains, look at what Donald Trump is doing. He's using American power to get the way, to get the political way for the political policies that he wants to introduce, not just in the US, but also to countries that have been dealing with the US for most of human history. And one of them, obviously, is South Africa. And one of them, obviously, is another one is obviously also the whole of the African continent as well. Because if you guys did not know or did not hear, there was a whole bunch of African presidents that went to Trump 2 weeks back. And it was in relation to the Americans negotiating with these African countries to take some of the deportees. And these deportees are criminals. Hardened criminals. Now I ask you, guys. International rules-based system says, or dictates, you don't ship people that are not from a country to another country. But here's the saddest thing of this particular scenario that I'm describing to you. The home country of these criminals have said that they don't want these guys back. They don't want them back. If you're a Namibian, you commit a crime in the US. But the Namibian police here in Namibia knew that you were a criminal. And you obviously found your way somehow to the US. And the US now tells Namibia, hey Namibia, come take your person back. Here he is. We caught him. He committed this particular crime. Please take him back. We don't want him. Because he's not American. And Namibia says, no, we don't want that guy back. Firstly, it actually spells that you are stripped of your citizenship. Because that is very humiliating. And secondly, since you became stateless now, or somehow, the US can ship you wherever. It could possibly even mean that they can ship you to the North Pole if they want to, so that the polar bears can chase you around. And that they don't have to pay for you. But you know what? There's something known as international human rights recognition that needs to be upheld. So, they negotiate with other countries, African countries sometimes. Apparently, Sudan, of all countries, got like 20 or 50 people in the past 6 months. And they're not even African, some of these guys. They're like hardened criminals. And this is ultimately what's going on there in the American context, specifically because this is as now people are being deported out of the U.S., that have overstayed their welcome. Now, obviously, I'm highlighting to you something of international immigration and migrationary scenarios. The difference of our particular discussion, obviously, is that the international rules-based system speaks towards a supportive system, a supportive base for immigrants and migrants and people that are running away from persecution and war and famine and other particular things that are putting their lives in threat or that are a threat to their lives. And here you've got the Americans deporting people to third countries, not even the home country of the people being deported, which makes things weird. And then they go and open up immigration, active immigration for people from a country that is not at war. I'm not talking obviously about the white South Africans that, you know, listed themselves as some sort of a refugee. But refugees from active conflict zones have not been, the border is closed. The American border is closed to them, which also explains to you, what does this international rules-based order speak towards? Is it based upon U.S. President to U.S. President's own interpretation with their own policies regarding how the U.S. positions itself in the world? Because guess what has happened in the last 6 months or 4 months in terms of Donald Trump's presidency? Is that the American tourist market has crashed. It has crashed. Let me say it again. The American tourism market is busy crashing. I'll say it again. The American tourism market is busy crashing. I'll say it again. The American tourism market is busy crashing. Why? It's not because major European countries and other countries have placed, travel warnings on, their citizens traveling to the US. They've actually indicated to their citizens, there's nothing we can do. If you show up there at an international airport in the US and the ICE, the immigration officials of the US, take you into custody, and they hold you in custody for as long as you were planning on being in the US, and then they release you. Now, what kind of a holiday is that? What kind of a respect system is that for citizens from one country visiting another country? Remember the principle that our former Minister of Home Affairs, Albert Kawana, emphasized, motivated, as thus also explained extensively, not just to lawmakers in the National Assembly, because here's one of the funny things, is that the opposition parties, none of them understood the tourism market. None of them. They were partially asking a question. Partially. But none of them still, till this day, understand the value that the tourism market can play for the overall upliftment of the everyday Namibian and for Namibians living in rural areas of this country. They still don't understand it. Yes, having food in your belly is very important. But in many cases, people want a job that adds meaning to their lives, because you've got to look at it as past just the food in the belly concept. Then, because then it means we can all just open up soup kitchens and and what's the thing's name? And food banks. Right? Right. So when you look at it in that scenario, Kawana was the only one explaining, specifically from an international relations perspective, how the Namibian tourist or the Namibian flying out of Namibia, which is a very small minority, mind you. That's a very small minority of Namibians. And I'm not talking about flying to another African country. I'm talking about flying to outside of the African continent, specifically to Europe and to North America. How that Namibian is treated. That Namibian has to pay an exorbitant amount of money because now the Americans have placed a $250 visa fee for a visa. A visa. When you come to Namibia, when you come to the US, a visa, $250. You know how much is $250? Listeners, 5,000 Namibian dollars. So it's 5,000 Namibian dollars to pay for a visa. Now, apparently, the visa is sort of like an insurance policy. If you come to the US, you overstay your welcome, you get deported, that money is used in the facilitation of deporting you. But if you stay within the allotted period, which is usually 3 months in terms of what I've seen in terms of the normative functions of, you know, a tourist visa, it's a 3 month period. If you stay within the 3 month period and you exit out of the US in that 3 month period, you get your money back. You get your $250 back. Your $5,000 Namibian dollars. You get it back. Just like that. It's an insurance policy. In the case that you overstay your welcome. Now what I just explained to you sounds, you would go, okay, that sounds understandable. That sounds decent. And then in essence, you then go and ask the next natural question is like, okay, so how much does it cost in Namibia? And I'll tell you that it costs below 2,000 Namibian dollars for that tourist visa. Below 2,000 Namibian dollars. And that below the 2,000 Namibian dollar mark, Namibia is still seeing a large influx of tourists coming to it. Why? Okay, firstly, we're pretty open in terms of our discussion, in terms of when that e-visa system came along. It made it a very accessible for this, for many tourists in the world to apply to Namibia. It makes it very accessible. Highly accessible. So when you look at this particular position, this particular aspect in terms of this tourism market discussion, the international rules-based system, yes, it doesn't say anything towards the tourism market. It doesn't speak anything towards ultimately what is to be expected. However, it literally does speak towards the ability for countries to actually have peaceful coexistence or peaceful, you know, relations with each other. But then the peaceful relations is based upon whose rules? Whose rules do we follow? Can I live by my rules and you live by your rules? Or do we first need to establish the playing field between each other? We'll quickly take a musical break, dear listeners, and we come back right after that as we are battling very, very, very quickly towards the top of the hour at 7 a.m. We'll be back after that. And obviously, we'll be, you know, heading into sort of like the last leg of this morning's discussion here in your number one talk radio station. This is my Sunday morning take, and you are on Eagle FM.
never had a place to call my own, and slept so many nights out all alone. I spent so many hours slowly breaking in, and finally found someone who let me in. But if I said too much, please let me know, it wouldn't be the first time I've been told. I got the stock in town, found this bitter cold.
Take a little while. We're in that storm.